Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event. And thank you for spending some of your Tuesday evening with us. We're going to talk about Brisbane property and flooding and the intersection of those two situations. And I've got Megan, who's going to come in just a moment. Just before I bring her in, I will remind you, as normally, that we don't provide specific property or financial or legal advice. This is a general conversation only. We do moderate the chat, so no racial slurs, please. This is as at the 12th of April, 2022. And if you'd like to get my attention, use at Walk the World in the chat. That'll make sure that I see your question. And I've also enabled Super Chat, which means that if you want to get your question to the top of the list, you can use Super Chat to do that, or indeed to make a contribution to what we do here, which will be greatly appreciated. Anyway, without further ado, let me see whether I can bring Megan in. Hello there.
Hello there. It's good to be back.
Great. Now, last time we were talking, which is about September, October time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Boom, boom,
yep.
Boom. Now we're going into maybe not quite so much of a boom.
Oh, look, it's a really different market, but gee, wow, it hasn't slowed down. It's kind of knocked our socks off up here. And look, we're going to talk through a lot of things tonight about the Brisbane property market, some of those X factor events that threw us for six. But you know, by and large, it has been a very, very busy time in the Brisbane property market.
Yeah, busy time, absolutely. And interestingly, one of the fascinating things which we'll get into is interstate migration. You know, the mix of properties that are for sale, the price momentum that's been quite strong. The question about some of the new building that's going on there at the moment, you know, there's a load of things. But before we get into the detail, just for those who may not know, just give us the sort of the 10-second whistle-stop tour of what you do, because you do so much, but it would be good for people just to understand a bit of it.
Do the relevant stuff, I guess. I've been involved in the Brisbane property market for about two decades. So about 20 years I've been both as a buyer of property and an agent. So most recently, the last 18 years, as principal of property pursuit buyers agents, we've bought about 900, nearly 1,000 properties for people over that period of time. And we have a very strict and structured selection process around that. I also co-founded the Home Buyer Academy with Veronica Morgan, and what we wanted to do with that particular system was to help people who weren't necessarily ready to, you know, particularly engage in the property market, but really wanted to fill themselves with a lot of knowledge to get some really good advice and a good way and system of getting themselves into the market. So really arming them with the information they needed. So Veronica and I are pretty passionate about that side of things, because you're going to hear a lot from me today about people buying or selecting the wrong asset and how important it is, particularly in hindsight, where you've been through a really difficult period like a flood, that if the asset selection isn't right, that it's really going to slap you in the face. And that's a really tough situation to be in when you've spent a lot of money on a property. So that's in a nutshell, I guess.
Terrific. No, that's good. And we've put links.
Property related.
Yeah, put links and things below for people if they want to find out more. And I have to say, those very podcasts that you do are brilliant. There's so much there, so much information. And
the podcasts are really interesting because we get to talk to people like you. So it's not just Veronica and I rattling on about things and sharing our knowledge. We actually get to bring other people's expertise in and put that in a context, which is really quite valuable for first-time buyers.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I keep highlighting the fact, and before you came on, we were talking, there's a lot of information that people could get their hands on if they knew where to look. And so one of the things that I love about these sorts of conversation is we can help people find out more stuff before they go and talk to a solicitor or even talk to an agent.
Yeah, or go and put an offer on a property before they've done the research and know which order to do things in.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of people are saying, are you using your mic or your laptop mic? I think you're using your normal mic, aren't you?
Mic's here. Can you, do you want me to check your settings? No, definitely using the Rode mic.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Try to lift it up. Maybe that's better.
I don't know.
Comments?
We'll see what the comments say. But anyway, it's, I don't know.
I'm just going to do a quick check of settings while
that's okay. All right. Information overload is a very common system with operating. Yeah, well, there's a lot of information out there if you know where to look. But the point is, with all this stuff, you need to actually know about the sources of information and which are critical and which aren't. So there we go. So it doesn't sound too bad to me, so I wouldn't worry too much. But people are just making comments about it. Now, let me just get you to sort of give a little bit of an overview. Prices and momentum in Brisbane has been extremely strong for the last few months, right? Mm. What do you think's been driving it? And which sectors of the market have been the ones that have been booming or, you know, not? Or is there anything that's really explaining it? Or is it, you know, what is it, the interstate migration, the 50,000 people coming up from Victoria, whatever?
So much going on. And I think this is going to fix the problem because I did have it on the wrong microphone. So thank you, everybody, for pointing that out. When we did our tests, it was right. And then when I popped my earpod back in, it went to earpod instead.
Okay. Well done, folks. That's a good spot.
That's really good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now let me just...
No more annoying thing than hearing an echo in the background. Martin, it's been such a roller coaster ride, and there are so many factors that are influencing prices in Brisbane. And when I talk Brisbane, I talk Brisbane basically local government area, not Greater Brisbane. So I'm not talking about Ipswich or Logan or Moreton or any of the local government areas outside of the Brisbane local government area. And I think it's important that I differentiate that, because those markets actually act independently of each other and they are performing significantly different to each other. So talking Brisbane local government area, so roughly about 12 k's from the CBD. There's so much that's happening at the moment. So one of the biggest things that has been a stifler of growth for Brisbane in the past, with the exception of 2002, 2003, which was our last really, really strong period of growth in Brisbane. But the thing that has been really difficult is that people who are aspirational and perhaps moving up in salary terms, in terms of their career growth, they don't often find the opportunities in Brisbane. So as people are growing in their careers, they look for those career opportunities and higher paying jobs in other locations. And those other locations are generally Sydney, Melbourne, or overseas opportunities. So as well as having people coming from interstate, because lifestyle is good, we're a lot more work from home opportunities, we're not having the exodus of talent that we used to have, because people are finding now in this post-COVID environment that they don't need to leave Brisbane to get well-paying jobs. They don't physically have to be in another location to do that. So not only have we got an absence of people leaving Brisbane, we've got an influx of people either repatriating from overseas postings that are now coming back and finding that Brisbane is the place that they want to put their family in during this post-COVID period, and the interstate migration. And I think a lot of that sits around the changing nature of the employment opportunities and the employment landscape. Now, how sustainable that is, I think that's yet to be seen, but that has put an awful lot of pressure on housing in Brisbane, because we haven't got people going, we got a lot of people coming in, and there's no new stock in Brisbane. And when I say stock, I'm not talking about apartments. Let's differentiate between freehold housing and apartments. We're talking about houses on land that are freehold, not stacked living. So the amount of people that are coming here looking for those properties within a 12K radius or 15K radius of CBD has increased significantly, but we are not having the exodus of people. So the net migration figures are actually quite a lot higher than they have been at any other time. And I don't have those figures on me, unfortunately. It wasn't one I put in there. But on the ground, you can see it. Mm. You can see the amount of people that are competing for limited properties.
So I think the latest ABS statistics I saw was that somewhere between 50,000 and 60,000 people had come into the the Queensland area. Most of those were in and around the Brisbane area, and quite a few of them had come from Melbourne and the surrounding area. Mm-mm. And others from Sydney and the surrounding area. And interesting, in my surveys, when I asked people about when they'd migrated, there were three drivers. The first driver was, well, COVID actually was a lot better managed earlier on in Queensland, so people were thinking that was good. Secondly, prices are much more acceptable, or at least they were. And thirdly, the rental and investment returns were a lot higher from an investment property perspective. It was also much better, compared with the net and gross returns in Melbourne and Sydney, which were both pretty poor. So there's a bunch of reasons why that was the case. And the final point is quite a few people who come into Australia come in through the gateways of Sydney and Melbourne, but then go elsewhere.
Yes.
And I did notice that in my surveys, quite a few of the people who were coming up to Brisbane were actually first-generation Australians. So they were relatively new, you know, migrants into Australia as well. Mm. So I think that's some of the factors that's been driving it.
Yeah, and the thing is, when you've got limited or scarcity, so there's no more land that's going to be created unless there's some subdivisions. So at best, you might turn one block into two blocks and have two freehold houses. But they're just not making any more land in Brisbane. You can't push out anywhere. There's nothing to be released. Certainly in other local government areas, there is still a lot of greenfield, a lot of space, a lot of house and land packages being released. That's a completely different environment and a whole different conversation. So not going down that pathway. We're talking about, you know, houses that are within that constrained area where you just can't build any more of it. And that scarcity factor is the thing that is driving growth. I also had a look at some NAB approval numbers, and I think it was from December last year. There's been quite an uplift in the number of first home buyers getting housing approvals, but actually a decrease in the upgrade or second home buyer market. And that's a really interesting thing to me, because what that's telling me is that a lot of people are finding that they're not actually upgrading the family home, moving on, so moving out of the first home and into the second home, because some of those opportunities just don't exist for them to upgrade. So there's almost like there's a bottleneck in the market, and we have seen it on the ground of, you know, entry-level houses selling, but people going from maybe a nice family home to a more substantial family home, there isn't anything for them to buy. So they're bottlenecking the upgrade process in Brisbane, and that's putting an awful lot of pressure on all price points.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's like a lot of things. There's always multiple dimensions to it, you know, you
factors,
can't point,
yeah,
you can't point yourself to one thing, but the combined impact is there for everybody to see. And then let's just sort of overlay now the flood story. So there was an interesting question that I got from Annie. Actually sent me this question beforehand. She said, look, we were looking at property in Brisbane, quite not very close to the river, but quite close to the river, and we asked the agent about flood risk. We were looking at this and we got quite seriously into it, right? And the agent said, oh, no, you'll never have any issues with flooding in this one. You know, it's too far away from the river, right? Blow me, the next week, she said, the place flooded.
They
didn't buy it. No. They'd actually not contracted to buy it, but they were seriously interested. And the question she asked me was, well, if we had gone ahead and bought it and then got flooded out, right, to what extent could we then go back to the agent and say, but you said it wouldn't get flooded out?
There's a couple of things there. I guess the first thing is what words did the agent actually use? And I guess we don't know what those words actually were. You know, if it was along the lines of, oh, no, it'll never flood, never has before, then there might be a little bit of risk there for the agent. But the basis of property law in Queensland is KVDM-TOR, which is in essence, let the buyer beware. And Queensland has the least amount of requirement for seller disclosure out of all the states in Australia. When Veronica and I did all of our research into the different ways, the different legislation, all of the different nuances in different states, and she still laughs hysterically every time we talk about it. In Queensland, the seller only has to disclose whether there's compliance smoke alarms, if there's a safety switch, not that it's working, but it's there, if there's a pool, that there's a pool safety certificate, or not one. Doesn't have to have one, but they just got to say that it doesn't. there's a couple of other aspects, but realistically, when you compare it to, say, Victoria, which has really quite strong seller disclosure with the 32A statement, I think it's called, and there's a number of prescribed pieces of information that have to be provided on that statement. That just doesn't exist in Queensland. So unfortunately, what it means is, as the buyer, you have to know what questions to ask who to ask them of, and how to verify the information outside of what you've heard from somebody's mouth, because anything that comes out of someone's mouth is pure rumour until you can verify it independently. So in this case, it actually is up to the buyer to do their own research. And this information is freely available. And you and I talked about it because, you know, one of the most common sites that we access as buyer's agents in Brisbane is the Brisbane City Council city plan, and it's 2014 was when the last one was bought out. And there are so many overlays, so many aspects that you can discover about a property on that website that you can do at any point in time, any day of the week, and it is completely free. It's some information that a solicitor will provide to you during their conveyance process, but actually you can get it before you even make an offer on a property. So I think that's really important, that as a buyer, you know where to go to and how to interpret the information and how it relates to you, and what's important, what isn't important, and what, you know, what might be important on one property might not be important on another, but you still have to do the research and the due diligence yourself in Queensland. And that's, I guess that's the key point, is when you're buying in Queensland, you are totally and utterly responsible for finding everything out about the property. Nobody else.
Exactly. You can't.
Nobody.
No, you can't outsource
it. You
can't
even blame the solicitor because, no. You know, if you don't instruct the solicitor correctly, then they don't know which searches to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just put this up. This is actually the Brisbane, well, one of the versions of the Brisbane map, right? And the fascinating thing about this is you can wander about around Brisbane and you can basically see on this map the different flood heights under different scenarios, right? And then you can actually drill in if you want to, and you can actually go down and look at specific areas, you know, this whole area here, right? So there's significant flood risk, right? Now, this is freely available.
So this is FloodWise mapping, I think you're on there,
it
isn't it?
It is, yes. Yeah.
So that's another tool that is freely available as well. Mm. And you can sort of navigate around and look at that. So there's a couple of different places that you can access that kind of information from.
Mm.
There is actually different modelling that's used on those two different systems, which can be quite confusing. So depending on whether you're looking at or what you're looking at the information for, whether you're looking at potentially doing a renovation, say a raise the house up, build underneath, extend the property, those sorts of things, then you need to be looking at the city plan version of the map, because that is what the town planners and certifiers will use when they look at different rules and regulations. That one's a really interesting one because it actually talks about different levels. So where your minimum habitable height is in relation to flood levels. So that actually gives you quite a good graph as well.
Absolutely. And this one here is actually showing different probabilities, right? So, you know, 5%, 1%, 0.2 and 0.05%, right? Which is one way of doing it. As you say, the other one is more specific in terms of heights and levels and things. But the other point I guess we should make is it's worth actually going and looking and working out just how high the particular property is you're looking at relative to the surrounding areas, right? Nice idea.
We're talking about that, weren't we? Because you had some neighbours who are a little in a bit of a dip in your street, and they had some water, and whereas, you know, it's almost like it's a gully. And that's you know, entirely true of Brisbane. The topography of Brisbane is so undulating. There's so many hills and surrounding areas that you can't even really make an assessment of a flood area or a postcode that floods. You actually need to go and understand, put your feet on the ground and understand, you know, where is that in relation to other properties? It might be elevated, but if there's something more elevated behind it, then maybe that is an overland flow path that will impact your ability to put in a pool or to develop a property or to end up with water running under your property. So you could actually, there are some parts of the flood maps where it shows that a property is in a flood, what they call a flood study area. But when you actually physically go there, it could almost end up being an island because it's so elevated in relation to the properties that are around it. You know, that in of itself brings in challenges if there's a flood and you can't get to your property. But I think feet on the ground and understanding the topography is vitally important once you understand where those flood areas are.
Yeah, and it's worth highlighting, of course, the fact that it's not just proximity to the river, you know,
because
you know, it can be a fair way away. And in fact, locally here, last week we had massive floods, and just one road over, there was a group of houses that got flooded out. And the reason they got flooded out was because there was a relatively small creek that went up 4 metres, which was, you know, almost unheard of. And the council hadn't done a very good job of clearing the debris further down, so that basically it all backed up. Now, that's going to be a court case. I can just see it now. You're right. Everyone's saying it wasn't me, it was somebody else, right? But the net effect was these people weren't close to the beach. They weren't down low, but mm-hmm. they were nevertheless between, you know, water up there and the sea down there.
It's got to go somewhere.
And it's got to go somewhere. Exactly right.
It's got to have a pathway. Yeah.
So it's really important to go those through. And you know, you got to underscore, and I think this is true of everywhere, not just in Queensland, is you have to do your own due diligence. You cannot just take it on trust that the agent says X, or you get a you know, a bit of a mumbo jumbo report from the vendor saying, well, here's the report about the building. So that we'll just take that then, right? unfortunately, it does not work like that.
Yeah. Look, the agent can't misrepresent. Let's be really clear. They can't misrepresent. If they know something about a property, they can't misrepresent it. But they don't have to reveal anything they don't know. Does that make sense? So they don't have to make inquiries about things unless you specifically ask them to make inquiries of the vendor about specific things. So to say to an agent, has this ever flooded before? And the agent says, oh, not that I know of. That's not misrepresentation. But if you were to say, can you please ask the owner, or even put in writing an email, can you please ask the owner, have they ever experienced any kind of flood, inundation, you know, and be quite specific about it, then there is an obligation on them to actually ask the vendor. And if the vendor doesn't provide them with truthfulness in response to that, then there is potential recourse on that.
Mm. Get it in writing.
Absolutely. And it's also how you ask the question, who you ask the question of, and how you direct that you want the response as well. That's really important, because just asking a bland kind of question, you know, does it ever flood? You know, no, not that I know of.
Yeah, exactly.
no time that I've been here has it flooded. That's true.
No. Well, that could be true. I mean, yeah. Now, I had another question again before the show, and this is quite an interesting one. This is actually relating to high rise. So this particular person is a tenant of a high rise property, right? And basically, the tenancy agreement is to provide the occupancy of the apartment, which is, I think, halfway up the building, right? And also a car space in the basement, right? Now, the car space in the basement is unusable. It's been unusable for weeks because of basically the basement was flooded. Right? And luckily they'd moved the car away, so the car wasn't damaged. But the question there was, well, should there be some recompense under the tenancy agreement for the fact that I could no longer get access to the basement car park, which was part of the tenancy agreement? I mean, what? That's another interesting aspect of how this flooding thing can play out.
There is, it is, isn't there? Because on one hand, you look at it and you say, well, has the landlord done anything that has caused the situation for which they should be, you know, punished by way of a rebate or decrease in rent? the answer in this case was clearly no, because this is a natural disaster. However, in our experience with dealing with and we manage 250 properties. It's not a large amount of properties. It's quite a boutique little rent roll that we've got. And of those, there are a number that actually had either leaking roofs or the swimming pool got, you know, completely muddied out, or those sorts of things. And what's happened in that case is tenants have been quite reasonable and said, look, I can't use the pool. Do you think the owner might drop the rent until the pool's back in working order? And it becomes a conversation of reasonableness in a lot of cases. I just saw a comment come up. Lifts is another good one. So, you know, you might be in a 20-story building, and if the basement has taken out all the water in the basement's taken out all the power, then you might not be able to use your lift. That's a lot of walking to do. If you're not that fit, and I don't know anyone who wants to do 20 sets of stairs every day. So would there be a case where QCAT would award in favour of a tenant in that situation. I think there would be reasonable grounds for that. But for a lot of people, it's about having a reasonable conversation around it, because no one caused it. There wasn't any negligence or willfulness on the owner's part in them losing the car park. But at the same time, they have lost an amenity that is part of the rent that they're paying, and there's value in that.
Yeah, and, you know, as with all of these things, you have to have a bit of give and take, but yeah. Also have a conversation, right? I mean, that's the whole point, isn't it?
I think that's the thing, and I think sometimes people get a little bit caught up in somebody's got to pay for something I've lost. And I think if we can remove that in some of these conversations, it actually ends up being quite, you know, you can get to a reasonable outcome, because everybody feels for the people who have been impacted by the floods. There wouldn't be a person in Brisbane that doesn't know somebody who's had some impact, either through their living arrangements or through their business. So I think there's a huge amount of empathy for people who have been impacted by what is a natural event. There's a whole other conversation that's outside of our area of expertise, Martin, as to whether we now look at this and say, can we continue to deny that something's happening with the weather here, because this is happening more often than one in 100 years? I mean, that's, you know, we've got to start looking at those sorts of things, I guess, when it comes to planning as well.
Well, that's right. So somebody said to me the other day, we've had a one in a 100-year flood, two in a month.
Yeah, and, right. And we've had three in 12 years.
Mm. Yeah, makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
and somebody else made the point earlier on, what about the structural impacts? You know, it's not just necessarily the goods in the property, but the structure of the property itself. And I guess, you know, foundational damage, water penetration, you know, having to rip out walls, and it can get horribly, horribly, horribly expensive. And that leads to another question which I have again beforehand, which was this. Well, you know, are there going to be bargains now because of the floods? Are there going to be people desperate to sell, and should I try and go buy one of those value opportunities? Discuss.
No. I'm going to get to some slides in a minute, because I really want to talk about some real examples of where people have tried to use this strategy, where it's worked and where it hasn't worked. And I would say in 99.9% of cases, it hasn't worked. And there is the odd wood duck that actually managed to time the sale of their property at the peak of the market before the flood. Mm. But the time frame they had that property was extraordinarily long, and it was absolute, you know, it's more arse than class, to be honest. There couldn't have been anything in there that said that, you know, let's do this, apart from some circumstances or maybe taking advantage of the market. So I am getting asked this a lot. I'm getting asked by friends. I'm getting asked by families at school. I'm getting asked, should I go and bag a bargain right now? Because there's got to be a lot of distressed sales. I am not a fan of people who go and chase distressed sales. If people have to sell a property under certain circumstances, then, you know, I feel empathy for them, but I don't think that taking advantage of people in that way is a very integral way to do business. Having said that, you've got to look at the quality of the asset, and at its core as a buyer's agent, what we are is we are exceptionally good at asset selection, understanding our local markets with the local knowledge that we have, with the impacts that different factors have on property prices, and looking at what differentiates, say, an A-grade property from a B-grade or a C-grade property. And I couldn't honestly, hand on heart, say that I've ever looked at anything that had either flood, creek, or overland flow, because that's a big factor in our flood mapping system in Brisbane, is the overland flow component, and that dictates or tells you where the water paths are that come when the water comes down the hills. I can't ever say that I've looked at a property and thought there was a price at which I would buy that property. 20 years. Not a price at which I would buy a property that's affected by that, by any of those factors. And the main reason is you can't overcome them.
No. And it's unpredictable, isn't it?
Well, it's predictable in that they're going to flood at some point in time.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
I mean, there's 100% certainty at some point in time that property will flood.
Yeah.
What you can't predict is when it's going to happen, and therefore you have to be, you know, better than any property professional on the planet to time the entry into that property at the lowest point and to time the exit out of it at the highest point. And the reason I say that is that the only examples of people making money or experiencing capital growth that is comparable to non-flood affected properties, so put the two categories here, properties that were flood affected in 2011. I might try the slide here because I'm trying to explain something that is better done graphically.
Right. Is that slide one?
No, we're way past that.
All right. Okay.
We flicked straight into flood. All right, let's go to five, please.
So there's your slides. And let me just go to that. Just tell me which one you'd like to see and I'll...
Number five.
There you go.
Yep. Okay, so this is going to be really hard to see and I apologise for that. It's actually one that I have, with permission, reproduced out of the Property Investment Professionals of Australia journal. And it was done, it was one of the columns that Eliza Owen from CoreLogic has done in that journal. And I really like it because as squiggly and as difficult as it looks, it is really telling. Now, what we've got, if you've got a point there, Martin, if you can find the 0% line running across there. So that's zero. Growth is above, negative growth is below. The first point there is 2011. So January 2011, around the 13th of January, I think, was the peak of the flood in that year. The dark line is Greater Brisbane. So unfortunately, I don't have a Brisbane LGA line to show you here, but this is Greater Brisbane. So you can see that it took about 3.2 years, I think it was, for prices in Greater Brisbane across all suburbs, including flood-affected suburbs, to recover back to that neutral position. So where they were December 2010 took about 3 years for prices to recover. But the flood-affected suburbs, so suburbs like Fig Tree Pocket, which is a riverfront suburb, but it's also very low-lying. So large amounts of that suburb suffer from inundation. Indooroopilly, very highly regarded suburb, but rivers all around Indooroopilly is river. And then you've got suburbs more affordable like Rocklea, that is really a floodplain. It's one of the few where almost every property was actually flooded. So if you find Rocklea, it took
this one here.
Sorry,
I
if
think.
You find yep. yep. If you find Chelmer, this is quite a telling one. It took Chelmer over 8 years for those properties to recover back to a neutral point.
I think it's this
now,
one.
That's not, that's not 8 years for every property to recover. That's the average across the suburb. Yep. So in a lot of cases, non-flood affected properties actually didn't suffer any kind of downturn in price. So that actually is largely driven by the drop in price of flood affected properties. So now overlaying on top of that, you know, all properties aren't equal. Those in the highly sought after areas and the non-flood affected properties actually had strong growth. So individually, when you take away the flood affected properties from the non-flood affected properties within suburbs, the non-flood affected ones actually didn't have dips in value.
Mm. So what you're saying is that actually that average masks, right? Because it's
absolutely.
It's a large area.
Absolutely masks.
Yeah, and interestingly, some analysis that I've did independently was suggesting that in some areas we see values dropping by up to 40 to 50%.
Yep.
In those areas where there is bad flood impact.
And I would say it's on a property basis as opposed to an area basis. Yep. And that's the thing I guess I want to really, really make really clear is don't talk about suburbs, don't talk about postcodes, don't talk about areas even, because it really comes down to the individual properties. And it's that due diligence that people do and should do that will stop you making the decisions that might put you in a position where you have negative growth for 8 or 9 years before you even start to have positive growth if a flood event actually does happen. And you can avoid it by not buying the bargain of a flood-affected property when prices are depressed, because they may go down further before they go up, and it may take a very long time for them to recover. And I think that's one of the, you know, the things that worries me about the bargain hunting of flood affected properties.
And the problem is, if you have another flooding event quite close, it will then take even further and longer before it actually comes back again, right?
Yes. Yeah. And put, like, the other thing that layers on top of this at the moment is actually the market factors that were in play before the flood happened. So we had the strongest price growth that we'd had since 2002 in a short period of time. Because I've said this to you on the show before. I liken the Brisbane property market to a Clydesdale. So if you had a horse race, then Sydney and Melbourne are probably the two-year-old geldings who absolutely go, you know, full on, they race like you wouldn't believe, and then they break down for a while and then they take off again. So they have more of the ups and downs in the medium house price. You know, you look at a graph and it's quite fun to watch. Whereas Brisbane tends to be a little bit more stable. It has a bit of a lift and then it just moves along. That has a bit of a lift and it just moves along. We don't tend to have these ups and downs unless we have an external factor affect it. So when we're looking at the horse race, the Clydesdale broke out of a trot in this current market, which is really quite amusing to me, because I haven't seen it since I first entered the industry in 2002. So the Clydesdale's got a bit of speed up and then it's got a bit of momentum, and suddenly Brisbane is now outperforming Sydney and Melbourne in terms of capital cities. We've got a lot of activity in the regional markets as well, which has been quite exciting. They may have peaked. But, you know, you're talking about properties that have had maybe 40% growth, but there are properties that should not have had 40% growth. And what I mean by that is, people stop because of the fear of missing out in this rapidly rising Clydesdale momentum, you know, pushing forward at a great rate of knots. It's almost like there was, I might even reallocate this to, you know, it's a carriage. What was the Cobb & Co? The Cobb & Co coach that had a massive amount of Clydesdale pulling it, and you can't stop the thing, and everybody's on it and trying to, you know, catch a hold of it and make sure they don't miss out. But this momentum has actually been driven by this massive fear of missing out, and it's meant that some people, a lot of people, have stopped differentiating between quality property. So what we've sometimes come back into the office on a Monday and had a bit of a collection, you know, which auction did you go to? What did you see? What were the behaviours like? What was the, you know, expectation in terms of price? What did it go for? How was the behaviour? You know, all those sorts of things that we analyse from a market perspective. You come back into the office and say, I cannot believe that somebody paid the same price for a three-bedroom renovator on 600 square metres in suburb X as they have paid for the same property in suburb Y, where Y has, you know, usually has a median house price of $1.3 million and the first suburb has a median house price of maybe $800,000. So people have stopped differentiating on some of the core fundamentals that actually drive property growth. And I've got a couple of examples here, and I want to show you, because flooding comes into this, all other things being equal. So if you go on to number six, slide number six. Now, this is a property. See the flood map on the left? So that is a creek that runs through a suburb. So there are houses each side of that creek, some of them well and truly covered by the creek in this flood map. And the property I'm talking about is just sort of slightly down the bottom and slightly to the right of centre there. So that property is well and truly a B-grade property. It suffers from full creek flooding. So the entire block is covered by creek flooding. You cannot raise that house up and build underneath it. So you're very constrained with what you can do with it. So in September 2010, that sold for $586,000. Now that market at the time was quite steady, and the median house price in this particular suburb was $700,000. This is a blue chip suburb, family friendly, good schools, big box, very low density, hardly any units and townhouses. So at a time when the median was 700, this property sold for 586. So it gives you a really good indication of how it compares to the average property in this suburb. So well below average. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is the flooding, and two, it's on the corner of a busy street. So there's two factors that can't be overcome there. In October 2021, which was really quite rapid growth, a lot of activity, you know, 10 to 15 bidders on properties, multiple offers on private treaties, people just not doing their research and not differentiating between properties, that sold for 1.370 with no improvements between 2010 and 2021. And it's that was in a peaking market. I'll talk about where we think the market is in a moment. But the median in that at that time is around $1.4 million in that suburb. So this is a classic example of what we're seeing in buyer behavior of not differentiating between different quality assets and not looking at the fundamentals that are actually underlying what you should pay. They're just throwing the kitchen sink at things to get into the property. Now, that property had terribly, very, very sadly, tenants move into it just after settlement, and they lost everything under the house. It came up, the floods came up under the floorboards. They lost all of the fencing around the property except for the pedestrian gate, which still has the house number on it and the bell that you ring at the pedestrian gate. That's the only thing that's left standing after that water rushed through and took out a large amount of their improvements. So we would probably put that now back at around 850, which is where it probably should sit had those people not been in that bubbled market that we've been seeing where people aren't differentiating between the fundamentals of the property.
And that's a scary story, isn't it? Because it shows you what happens in an over-exuberant market. As you say, yep. Everything then tends to go up, and people get less discriminating about different types of property, you know, the, yep. the dogs and the stars, the A class and the B class and the C class. Yeah, everybody assumes everything's
we'll call
always
them different things, but yep, we all talk about the same thing. And the fundamentals, if you don't understand, looked okay. It was a flat block of land, over 875 square meters, walked to the schools, walked to the shops, you know, there's lots of, you know, close to a park, park floods. So there was lots of things there. But if you overlook the thing that cannot be changed, that in the long run actually will affect the price, then that's where you're going to run into a lot of trouble. And unfortunately for these people, they were from interstate, they're investors. They probably didn't do the right due diligence or understand the local factors in making their decision on that. They saw a big block of land in a great suburb with you know, good schools around it and other high quality properties slightly higher up the street that were achieving very good prices.
And almost certainly when they you know bought it, it was cheaper than the ones up the road, and they didn't stop to think about why that might be the case.
Back in 2010? Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, that tells the story there, yeah. I think. It was 586,000 when the median was 700,000. So it clearly shows that is below the median for the area. Therefore, it's not a sought-after property, but you know, people paid close to the median during this peaking period. Mm. That really worries me, because they're the sorts of properties that I think once the puff comes out of the market, there's going to be a bit of a struggle there with an equity position at some point in time.
Mm. And it's interesting, because quite a few people at one stage were buying sight unseen, weren't they?
Unfortunately, yeah. During lockdown, there was a lot of it.
Exactly.
And look, that is okay if you're engaging a professional who's acting purely in your interests, yep. and is giving you really reliable and independent information and quality photographs. And we did a lot of Zoom walkthroughs and those sorts of things. Virtual tours that the agents produce are beautiful. They showcase the property beautifully, but it won't show you, you know, the outside of the laundry or where, you know, there's factors that you just won't see in those beautiful marketing videos that you need to. And people are still buying a little bit sight unseen at the moment, although there's a little bit more moving around. But you can't just rely on marketing material to buy a property, and you can't rely on an agent to whose job it is to sell the property to any buyer for the highest price. You can't rely on them or expect them to show you what might be the challenges of the property.
No, and you know, just looking at Street View, as I've spoken to a few people, is, well, I looked at Street View to have a look what was around in the local area, and I looked at the map. Yep. Yes, and...
No, and how old was it? Yeah,
exactly.
And what about the developments that are going on around it?
Yes.
Who's doing renovation?
Yeah.
How's that going to impact on the property?
I always say, look at the planning zoning, right? See what's going on there, right? Look at the flooding, right? Look at the crime maps. You know, there's lots of good information that might tell you something. And then the other point is, if it does look mispriced relative to other properties in the same area, right, you've got to ask yourself a really hard question, right? Is there a reason why it is cheap? And it might be.
Such a good question.
Yeah, yeah.
It is. And in a normal market, that is a really good reflective question. And I want to have a look now, if I can, at the next slide, which is slide 7. It's just another example. This is actually over Sherwood Way. So, again, near the river, but not too close to the river. But this is just the way that the actual river comes into the suburb. Not bad in and of itself. Blue chip suburb, well regarded. But this particular pocket is certainly the lesser of the four or five pockets that are in that particular suburb. The house is okay, but, you know, we call it a clunky layout, but actually think you could fix that. So that's a problem that can be overcome, and that doesn't make it any less of a quality asset if you can overcome it without overcapitalizing. So a few caveats there, but a bit of a clunky layout. But it has flood. I mean, this is one of the worst flood maps that you can see for a property. These are the types of properties that you saw on the morning shows and the news where they were driving along in boats. This is what we're talking about in these sorts of areas. And looking at the progression of sales here for this particular one, in 2009, it sold for 730. Now, that was a peaking market at that time. Resold again for 775 in 2012. Now, people's memories were still pretty strong there. It was only, you know, coming up to the two-year anniversary of the floods, but it was actually a rising market at that time. So you can see there wasn't a huge amount of growth there. But then in 2015, it resold for 842,500. Now, that was the start of the credit squeeze. Resold again in June 2021 for 1.2. Now, that just, it almost made me sick to my stomach that someone paid that much money for that property in that position, because what you can do with that property in that position is so limited, and it is always going to have the stigma when the pressure of a really tight market is relieved. So our estimate on that one now is about 950 post-flood. And we won't see the data for those sorts of things for some time, but it will be coming through. And then that whole cycle of how long it will take for that property to catch up to the general market again because of the negative dip before it rises is why we recommend very strongly against buying the bargain of a flood-affected property.
Mm. And like I said, also, the other factor to bear in mind is that if there has been a lot of flooding in the area, you could have other structural issues, like, for example...
Yeah, we didn't even get into that conversation. Yeah. We've sort of flicked right past it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to bring back to it, because I actually... There's two points I want to make. The first is you may well have foundation issues. The other point I noticed in watching some of the television coverage when they were just stripping everything out, right, I think asbestos... Asbestos, you know, there's could well be asbestos, and I've got a particular interest, as you know, in highlighting the risks of asbestos. I don't think that adequate precautions were being taken, and people were just, you know, desperate to sort of try and just clear it out. There's a bunch of questions that you've got to think about from a structural perspective if you're dealing with flooded property, and you know, as well as the mold and everything else. It's the structural
questions. Mold. Oh, yeah. My God.
Yep.
And it's a really good point that you make, because a lot of the Queenslander style properties are built on stumps. So they might be concrete, they might be metal, they might be the original timber stumps. They might be, you know, roughly head height or maybe a little bit more higher if the house hasn't been raised. And so what is under there is sometimes just a dirt base, or it may be a non-structural concrete slab. So what happens when there's a great deal of water is those stumps start to become a little unsettled. And even a property that's 100 years old, if there's too much water, then you start to get your stumps actually dropping. So the stumps that actually sit under the joists that then have the under the bearers that then have the joists on top and then your floorboards. So those stumps that are holding that house up and even, if you like, it starts to become uneven because, you know, most of our properties here are timber and tin. So they've got to have a little bit of movement. That's just what they were designed for. But they're not designed to have a 2, 3, 4-inch drop in a stump or several stumps. And that change to what they're sitting on is one aspect of it. But if the property is built in underneath or is a single level house, and as you say, the water has actually come in, then you start to look at, you know, does that actually have an effect on the integrity of the slab? Does it at some point in time end up needing underpinning because it's actually dropped in a corner or in some point? But the mold, when you said mold, the mold is probably one of the really concerning things that is hard to get rid of, because once it's in there, the spores just keep moving and growing. And that's probably one of the things after the post, 2011, that people struggled with the most was it was almost impossible to get rid of the mold unless you literally stripped the house back to bare bones. And even then it was still kind of building itself on the structural framework. That doesn't sound structural, but it actually is, because you can't then build over the mold and resheet walls and put cladding on the outside again. You've got to keep going until you get rid of it.
Yeah.
And it's a massive health problem.
Yeah,
like
I was going to say that
massive health impact.
Correct, because the spores are also very, very destructive in terms of personal health as well. This is a very important point. I think it's really important to underscore the journey of pulling a property back if it's been flooded is not straightforward, right?
No.
And of course, at the moment, the other factor is you can't get the parts, you can't get building materials, you can't get labor because there's too much demand and not enough people are actually able. So again, I was talking to somebody the other day who's out of their home now for months and there's no prospect of getting back into it anytime soon.
Mm.
Now, luckily, they were insured. So at the moment, they're being paid for to live somewhere else. But there is a limit as to how long that is going to be paid for by the insurance company, right? So they got this burning fuse on one side where effectively they're counting down to the point where the insurance payments stop and they can't get anybody to actually deal with the structural issues they got in the property, right?
Oh, it's harrowing, isn't it?
It is.
They're lucky to find a house in this rental market.
Well, they had to go out of the area to do it.
Right.
But then that's then the question is, well, do we just cut our losses and just sell and, let somebody else solve the problem, which is back to, well, you might think you're buying a bargain, but are you really? Because, the chances are somebody else is going to have to deal with all those problems anyway. But it just shows you how complicated and how difficult it is. And I just want to put up this quote from earlier on from Zach, which said, insurance quotes, $10,000. If you can get insurance, flood insurance, it costs you an arm and a leg. And in some areas, you can't actually get the insurance, can you?
Yeah, I think there is, and I'm not going to name them because I don't know factually, but post-2011 where people were underinsured or sometimes not insured, there was quite a groundswell of activity around ensuring that there was insurance options available. And I know there is an insurer that will provide flood cover on any property, but the premiums are astronomical. You're talking sometimes in the vicinity of $12,000 or $15,000 for a family home, and that's per annum. And that's just not not really something that most families can afford when you put all the other costs of living on top. So is it uninsurable or is it completely unaffordable, I guess, is the thing that we've found when I've heard sort of that anecdotal feedback on people, why didn't you have insurance? Because I couldn't afford the $15,000 a year was some of the answers that I got.
Yeah, and of course that's year after year after year. You have to pay those costs every year, and then that, you know, adds further to the overall cost of living. And by the way, if you're
like having another private school fee, but you're actually getting nothing in return.
Well, no, exactly right, because you're basically trying to protect yourself from something that may or not happen. And by the way, tenants, right, if they're actually looking to get property, personal effects insurance in property flooded areas, have to pay through the nose for it as well.
Yeah, they do. Mm. Yeah. So it doesn't have an impact. And unfortunately, that then leaves some tenants open to the possibility that they choose not to insure and through no fault of their own could end up with, you know, in some cases, total loss. And that's devastating when you lose your home and your personal effects as well and have no insurance to cover or recoup anything. You know, there's things that you can never replace and then there's things that can be replaced, but now, sometimes you haven't got access to that if you can't get the insurance money.
No, indeed. In fact, I was talking to somebody the other day again who was burnt out in the bushfires and got flooded out.
No.
It's like, what else could go wrong? You know, and each time.
No, don't ask.
the insurance premiums just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and ultimately. That they concluded that they needed to move somewhere else because basically it was just not going to work for them.
Now, it is a real question, Martin, that people are asking themselves and asking of other people at the moment. And I did hear and I overheard a conversation between relatives recently where some people who had been flood affected were saying, well, what do we do? Do you think, you know, what about our pride? We bought this and we made this decision and it's our life savings that we've put into here. If we sell it at such a loss, you know, what does that do to how people perceive us? And that might sound shallow and superficial in the light of things, but when that's what you've worked towards and your heart and soul is in there and your family is being raised in that and it's a decision that you made that you thought was a good one, that does affect how you reflect upon yourself.
Yeah, and that's what one of the things I wanted to highlight today. This isn't just an economic conversation, right? It is actually a social, a relationship thing, a personal thing, a psychological thing, all of those factors which I think sometimes people don't put into the mix when they think about this sort of stuff. Oh, you can just rebuild or you can, you know, you can just claim on insurance. No, there's a whole nother level of pain. And again, talking to this particular individual, you know, over the last 3 years, they've had a series of these crises, and each time they've not been able to bounce back as quickly or as fast. And the sort of you end up this sort of in this negative spiral. And sometimes the only thing to do is to cut your losses and get out and just say, "I've got to find a way to start again." Right? It really is quite disturbing to hear some of the what people say. So I just wanted to underscore that as part of this conversation too.
I think it's a really important point because we are at the base of things. We're human beings, and it's sometimes easy to overlook that when we have conversations about property and price growth and, you know, those sorts of things. But really, property and price growth is all driven by human beings and behaviour.
Mm.
The properties don't price themselves. We price them. We're the human beings that price the property.
Absolutely. Either logically or illogically, it's we're to blame. Now, here's a question from Stripey Cat, which I thought was quite interesting. Would you suggest tightening up buyer's protection laws in Queensland, only making it legal to sell with a Victorian type section 32, which shows things such as caveats on title, easements, et cetera, et cetera. So the regulations in Victoria are a bit tighter, although actually they're not as tight as I think many people think they are.
Yeah, look, there's a level of disclosure that has to be made, but you know what that is. And I think the problem is that people don't know what it is that they don't know in Queensland or how much they have to find out themselves. There's an expectation that information will be provided. And it's not it's not anyone else's responsibility to do that but yourself when you're the buyer of the property. So would I like to see it? Oh my God, yes. I would like to see a lot more requirements on sellers. I would like to see them have to do a lot more in the preparation of the sale of a property to provide a lot of additional documentation. I mean, one of the really, really big things that people overlook, and this is going to come back to slap a lot of people in the face when they haven't done the due diligence during this period of time when they've just thrown money at places, is there are a lot of unapproved additions to properties in Brisbane. And it might be 30, 40 years ago, a Queenslander that was just under legal height or habitable height, which is 2.4 metres for a habitable bedroom, they might have gone, oh, it's only 2.2, we'll just put a couple of bedrooms down there for the kids as they become teenagers. And then that suddenly becomes regarded as bedrooms, but it's actually not bedrooms. And this sort of perpetuates itself until somebody like us steps in and goes, all right, well, we need to see the certification for these bedrooms that are downstairs. Oh, I don't know, that was done years ago. Well, in Sydney and I think in New South Wales and Victoria, that kind of information has to be provided. So you can't have unapproved structures and not declare it. Whereas in Queensland, you could actually buy something that doesn't have a single legal structure on it, but it might have a house, a pool, and a shed. And because no one's ever come from the council and said, hey, here's a show cause notice as to why you shouldn't have to rip that down because you never got certification to get it built, it's just kind of gone on and on and on as it is. But if you end up being the buyer of that property and you haven't done the due diligence correctly and got the evidence that it is certified, then that's exactly what the council can do. If your neighbour suddenly goes, you know what, I don't like that ugly shed in the background, in the backyard, I'm going to check with the council. Oh, it's not approved. Council can actually hit you with a show cause notice as to why you should not you either get it certified, and retrospective certification is possible, but very expensive and very difficult, or tear it down. And if you can't get retrospective certification, it doesn't meet code, and it has to meet current code, not the old code. Then you can actually have to rip down something that you have paid money for when you've come into the property thinking that it was, you know, correct, okay, and well, hunky-dory, and I'll pay what that property would be worth if it was all certified and above board. So you've suddenly got potentially a hugely devalued property. And the other thing, and this is relevant from a fire, flood, whatever the case may be, these unapproved structures are uninsurable. So if the property was to burn down and the whole downstairs area had been built in, but it wasn't certified, it wasn't the correct heights, it wasn't built to code at the time and didn't have certification, you can't get retrospective certification. If that house burns down, then the only thing the insurance is going to cover is what was actually certified and approved on the property. So if you've thought that you've paid for a 5-bed, 3-bath, 2-level house, but actually what you've got is a 1-bed, 2-bed, 1-bath, a single level house, then what you're going to get in return versus what you paid is going to be a fairly big gap there. And that is one of the biggest concerning things that people, I think, go into purchases thinking, well, that's okay, the solicitor will find that out. The solicitor may well find that out, but unless you've got a clause in your contract, and it's a conditional contract that has the right clause in it, there's no way you're getting out of that contract. If you bought it at auction, there's no way you're getting out of that contract because there's no remedy in the contract if you find any of those types of things out. You've got to do all that due diligence before you put a contract on a property.
Yeah,
I'd love to see a lot more disclosure.
Yeah, and I'll make one other point, and that is some of the, less expensive conveyancing entities that just do the minimum in terms of shifting the, they often don't...
Ticking the boxes.
Yeah, they actually don't ask any of those sorts of questions, right? And mm-hmm. I had my own personal experience when, in fact, we discovered by coincidence, because I looking at the map thinking, what was that, that actually there was an easement that nobody picked up, right? I picked it up and dealt with it. But the conveyancer wasn't interested, right? They were just saying, well, we're just ticking the box and just, So it's really interesting that you can't even necessarily rely on the conveyancer to pick all this stuff up, and it's almost too late anyway. So you've got to do the due diligence beforehand.
Yeah, and know what to ask, yeah, and who to ask, and how to find the information. And yeah, some of these things are going to cost money, but they're going to save you an awful lot. I think the value of the money that you spend before you enter a property or enter into a contract on a property, if you don't end up buying that property, the money that you've spent because you found something out is worth its weight in gold. Sometimes it's the properties that you don't buy that are the better decisions than the property that you do buy, if you've done your due diligence and you've found something that should make you stop in your tracks and not go ahead.
Absolutely. Well, in my last buying spree, we actually, I think, looked at four or five properties that we thought we wanted to progress, and in each case we started to progress, and then we started tripping over the issues and we actually pulled out. Right, definitely the right thing to do, because we ended up paying a little bit more than we might have otherwise, but for very good reasons. Like in one property, we found that there was effectively a whole area in front of the property that could be redeveloped at any time, and there was no necessarily planning controls on that. So our views of the ocean could have been taken away before we'd actually got very far, right? And then another one.
Ooh, so that's interesting, because there is, it's hard to quantify, but there is value in a view corridor. And if that view corridor can be interrupted, as you rightly point out, if you can't control that view corridor, either via air and light easement or some other mechanism to control a view corridor, then your risk is that you lose quite a lot of value.
That's the whole point.
Not only amenity,
exactly right. And this was one where the land was actually owned by a holiday park, and they had basically unlimited easements to build whatever they wanted to do, wherever they wanted to do it, all the way along. So that was an interesting one. And then there was...
Did you ever go back to it and find out if anything was built there?
Went back about 5 years later, and blow me, they'd built in front of it. So, it was a good decision. And the other one, we actually got quite a long way down buying, but there was this outbuilding, which was a big double garage. Right? And then we started thinking, well, hang on a moment, it's not on any of the plans, it's not in the maps. And then we realised that actually it wasn't actually an authorised building.
Yep.
It had been put up by a builder at the back of the property, right, without any permissions. Yep. And so we did a bit of further checking, and that was an illegal building. And then you go exactly your point. Once it's illegal and the council knows about it, then it's very hard to retrospectively get approval for it. And in fact, the fact that it was of a scale and size that was massive relative to the property and the block suggests that you'd have never actually got it approved. So we walked away from that one as well.
Good due diligence and knowing what to look for, and knowing the impact as well.
Yep.
I think that's vitally important for people.
Yeah, and that's why I sometimes tell these stories, because it perhaps brings to life more than just saying do your due diligence. Here are some practical examples.
Due diligence, okay. But it is a bit like that, because what is it? And it's different in each state, and it's even different in different jurisdictions and local government areas.
It's actually different for every property. Because every property is unique, and therefore there are going to be unique issues that you need to think about, right? So you have to have a long checklist. So I reckon there's a checklist of about 50 or 60 items you want to go, yep, and just walk down the list, right? So.
Yeah, I think nothing more valuable than a good checklist. We certainly have a lot of those in the course that we run.
Absolutely. I was going to mention it. Exactly.
You can tick it or you can cross it. Exactly. And then you can work out whether it impacts you or not. And that's the thing. Just because you find something adverse doesn't necessarily it's going to adversely affect you. It might affect someone else, but then you've got to think about that long-term prospect of it.
Absolutely. Now, this is another very interesting question from Jason. And Jason, thanks for the super chat too. Do I or you, Megan, believe that taxpayers should pay to relocate people from extreme flood zones, which are expected to flood again, regardless of the insurance? Wouldn't it be cheaper in the long term to give taxpayer fund rescues?
That's a hard one, Jason. Really, that's quite political, that one, isn't it? And we're in an election period, and I don't think I'm going to go there. But I do think that there are a lot of people who have contributed to where houses have been built and forced through approvals for their own benefit. bending the rules and so forth to get something through on blocks of land that should never have been approved. And to a great extent, some of those people are responsible for their own downfall. So that personal responsibility side of things of doing the right due diligence, but also then making a conscious decision to build something that really shouldn't be built somewhere, but having, you know, it's like building, you know, I'd love to one day be in a position where I could build on the ocean front, but we know that the ocean front is disappearing, like the ocean's getting closer. So how much and how long can you keep putting it back and keeping it in place? There's a risk there, and when you choose to take that risk, then sometimes the consequences are so great. But is that the government's responsibility then to change that? I think what really perplexes me about this one is I grew up in Lismore. So as everyone would be very well aware, Lismore has suffered a tremendous amount of loss. And growing up there, we had a number of floods that would come into the city centre, and my parents had business there, and you'd go down and you'd help everybody clear out their businesses and move the cars out of the car yards up to higher ground and so forth. And Lismore's basically a basin with a river running through it, significant river running through it. And I look at that town, and one of the things that I've battled with as a person in property who thinks about property from all different angles for a long time is, how do you rehouse that community? You can't floodproof that area. You just can't. It's not possible. So it almost goes to Jason's question of how do you rehouse those people outside of the high risk areas and almost the city centre?
No, it's a big question.
It's a massive conundrum.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, but there's an interesting observation. It's certainly true in certain areas around Sydney. There have been considerable development on the floodplains in recent years, right? Masses and masses of new developments. People in the area knew they were building on floodplains, right? And the question is, was there appropriate planning and due diligence done, or did people look the other way? I don't know, but, you know, maybe paper bags of money were handed through and people got approvals they should never have got. But I can tell you in the UK, they've gone through the very similar processes. So there was a lot of poorly built property on floodplains, and then suddenly the climate started to change and the flooding is, and they've got thousands and thousands of properties now that keep getting flooded, and they've got exactly the same debate, you know. So where does accountability lie, you know, mm-hmm. whether you're insured or whether you're not insured? If you basically pay money to people who aren't insured rather than to those who are insured, does that encourage people who have insurance not to hold insurance because they're going to get bailed out next time? Does that mean that you've basically given a free shot, right? And as you say, the complexity of moving an entire area, including not just houses, but, you know, the rest of the infrastructure and schools and all those things to somewhere else, that's a huge, huge situation.
It's almost unfathomable, something has to change.
Well, something does have to change. I would have thought the first would be to say, well, hang on a minute, let's stop any further building on floodplains, right? Recognising that we're going to get more of these floods and recognising that sea levels are also rising, by the way. That's another factor which people should factor in. So as well as looking at river flooding, look on the coast, look at the flood levels on the coast. And again, there are maps for that too. People would be surprised as to where those lines are, because there are lots of properties. That's like a million properties around the edge of Australia that is at risk of flooding down the coast.
Within a very short number of years.
Correct. Yeah. Exactly
we're
right.
We're not talking decades.
No, we're not anymore. That's right. And, you know, the rate at which sea levels are rising is increasing, and we get the higher tides and the wind and everything else. So there's a bunch of factors there. So we need probably a more sophisticated approach to planning in the first place. And I think
But we're always going to be attracted to the water, and that's that human side of us too. We like that amenity. Yeah. We like being as close as we can. Many people like to be as close as they can to the beach and to see it and to it is an absolute pinnacle of success and prestige to have something where you can see the water or walk straight out on to the water.
Cookie Boy now, that says fishing from your living room. There you go.
Look, I personally didn't get any inundation, but I had a lightning strike at my house. So there was one lightning strike in our area, and it was my place that got hit. So it was a whole different experience for me.
Yes. Well, we actually
hit the house, blew out the lights, the oven, the toaster, the TVs. Yep. It was quite remarkable.
Well, again, another war story from my end. We actually had a lightning strike on a local big tree. The big tree fell over and pulled the power cables down, and that created a power surge. And the power surge basically blew out the electrics in the house, and I had to get, you know, a bunch of stuff replaced, right? And it was a very interesting debate with the insurance company about what caused it, right? Because basically the tree was the first cause, and then it created the secondary cause. Oh, it took months to settle. So it's an interesting example of, one thing creates another thing, But, at the end of the day, we got it sorted eventually. But it just shows you that sometimes real life gets in the way.
Oh, God, Mother Nature, when she unleashes, she gives us a hard time, that's for sure.
Absolutely, particularly, I have to say, in Australia, the big storms. Well, look, we're getting into the last 15 minutes, and I had a few questions earlier on about the future trajectory of property, right? And that's obviously expectations potentially of higher interest rates ahead. I mean, most people seem to be suggesting that rates are going to rise at some point. The migration question, it looks as though the migration levels will be up, but not dramatically up. And we also know that some of those people who moved up to Queensland are maybe regretting and maybe thinking, well, maybe I should move back now. So how do you see the next, 6, 12, 24 months for property in and around the Brisbane area? And can we separate it out between standalone houses and the high rise? Because I think there are some different dynamics going on between those two.
We've for the last maybe 8 years, 7 or 8 years, talked about almost a two-speed property market in most capital cities, and that is the detached dwelling property market versus the high-rise, high-density property market, and how they perform significantly differently to each other. And I think what we're going to see... Sorry, I'll go back one step. Property clockwise, if you think about that concept of where the property market is, and I don't believe in an Australian property market, I think much more granularly much more micro than that when I think about property prices and property aspects. But the property clock at the moment, and this is slide 2 if you want to flick to it, this is the first time in 2 decades in property that I have seen most markets performing in the same way. So this is a property clock where you see at the top the peaking market, at the bottom of the market, on the left a rising market, on the right a declining market. So you can see for detached houses, almost all markets are performing in the same way, which is just almost unheard of. It'll be a snapshot in time that I don't know that we'll see reproduce any times in our lifetimes.
So just to be clear, normally you'd expect to see a more distribution around the clock in different areas, right? That's right. Whereas at the moment it's all sitting over in this area, which is, rising market approaching a peak, that sort of area, right? That's what this clock is saying.
And this is Herron Todd White, who are national valuers. They are in a lot of properties in a lot of regions, so they're really across the market at a very granular level, at an individual property level. So they've got good on the ground data and intel that they actually use. So that's that's where they see the property market at the moment. Brisbane's in amongst that rising market sort of area over on the left. And I think from our point of view, feet on the ground, we're still seeing upward pressure on prices. Excuse me. And that's coming from the continued repatriation of people coming back from, particularly now we're seeing an influx from Hong Kong of expats moving home. That's a very difficult environment over there at the moment. And still that interstate migration. And we are not seeing the exodus of people still. So the pressure on property prices for detached housing is continuing. However, we are starting to see a little less competition at each individual property. So back in at the peak, where we would consider the peak was probably around December, leading up to Christmas, that's where we saw the most amount of multiple offers on private treaty and the most amount of registered bidders actively bidding on auctions in Brisbane. So that may be a peak of activity. Since then, of course, we've come into that January period, which is traditionally where people from Brisbane go to Noosa for a few weeks and nothing happens. So it's an exodus for a short period of time. And then coming into, of course, the flood, people going back to school, flood and so forth. This is starting to settle now into what I think is the pattern for the coming months. And I don't crystal ball. I can only talk about buyer behaviour at a particular point in time and fundamentals that sit around that. But, you know, we've got a federal election now being called, so there's a lot of uncertainty around that, but I don't see a lot in there for property owners. But the inflationary pressures from the higher costs of living, I think that's going to potentially have a big impact on buyer behaviour and how much discretionary income people have. Not only potentially the upward pressure on in interest rates, but you know, we're talking about diesel. It's $2 a litre at the moment. Even once the excise was dropped, unleaded is sitting around $1.60. That's still a really high price for petrol, and that's just to get around. Haven't even looked at the cost of renovation or works on properties. I talk to electricians who tell me that a more than 40% increase in the cost of copper. That's one thing that an electrician needs in their process, a 40% increase in that one thing. And across the board, most of the other building materials have been going up exponentially as well. So there's those sorts of pressures that are causing a little bit of uncertainty, I think, for some people. But we still have really low supply. So again, taking out now a large number of properties, and we haven't even talked about the rental side of things. That's we need to do that show, because there's a huge amount to talk about on the rental side of things. But there's a large number of properties that are now being taken out of the potential property pool as a result of the floods. Those people have had to go into temporary accommodation, which in most cases is a rental property, which has put further pressure on rental properties. As I mentioned earlier, we've got less properties for rent in Brisbane than we had 2 years ago because owners have moved back into them or sold them. So the turnover from the number of properties that are available 2 years ago, pre-COVID, to what's available now has actually decreased. And I know that's really hard to put, it's hard to say but it's a fact, because there are, I don't know how many properties are affected, somewhere in the vicinity of 15 or 20,000 properties are flood affected. They're not going to be fixed in the next couple of weeks. Before this even happened, a couple of years ago, there was a massive hailstorm that affected Springfield. So that sort of subdivision land, house and land subdivision out southwest of the CBD. And a huge, huge number of roofs out in that housing development were damaged. We haven't been able to get roofers to fix leaks and so forth for about 6 or 9 months because they're all out there doing insurance work. So to actually get a roofer before the floods was damn near impossible. It is impossible now. We're talking about 6 to 9 weeks just to get a roof leak repaired. So that takes a whole nother load of properties out of the market when you can't live in a property that's got a leaky roof.
Yeah, absolutely. And just another anecdotal, I was talking to a builder today, windows for a new property, they've gone up 40%. And yes, the delivery time frame, which was originally 12 weeks, has now shot out to 36 weeks. So basically they've got this shell, and they can't
lock up.
They can't put windows in because they can't get any.
Yeah. Look, on the positive side of things, it is still more affordable to buy a property, a comparable property in Brisbane, and that is from in Sydney and Melbourne.
Mm.
And that often is one of the drivers of attractiveness for people to either invest in Brisbane or to move here, is that affordability factor. It's when that affordability gap lessons and lessons and lessons that we start to see price growth come off a little bit. I don't think we're there yet, from what I've seen. So there's the affordability factor, but of course we've got very low unemployment as well. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people in full employment. Hang on, I've just lost my earpiece.
All right.
I can't hear you. Might hear me, but I can't hear you.
I can hear you. Yeah. I can hear you. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Technical difficulties at the end.
Okay. We'll just get the technical stuff sorted out. As with all of these things, there's always the old thing that happens. But the point I was going to make was that, you know, to my mind, interest rates are going to rise, and that's going to put a lot of pressure on households that already are sitting on big mortgages. We also know that banks are beginning to lend a little less relative to incomes than previously, because they're now effectively taking account of significant rate rises ahead. And that's going to put a bit of dampener on mortgage momentum, I suspect. But the fact that in Brisbane in particular, the supply of standalone houses is relatively limited is a problem. On the other hand, there's quite a lot of development of high-rise in and around Brisbane, and there's more coming on stream. So I wonder whether the high-rise sector is in for a further correction rather than an acceleration. Now, are you back or are you not back? She can't hear me. Okay. Yeah, because it's an interesting question as to how this all plays out with regard to the high-rise sector.
Gotcha.
Okay, she's back. Well, wonderful. Okay. Phew.
Apologies. I had earpods in and it went flat.
Okay.
Talk yeah. too much, Mark.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Well, you know, hour and a half, I suppose it's fair. I was just talking about apartments and the fact that there's still a supply of new apartments coming on. There's still more approvals in and around Brisbane happening. And it doesn't look at me as though the apartment market, particularly the high-rise, bog-standard, you know, cookie-cutter apartments, are that doing that well. But the more boutique type of apartments, and there are a smaller number, look to be doing a lot better. So, again, you can't really even bucket apartments into one market, can you?
You can't put them all in together. And I talked about, you know, that two-speed property market, which used to be considered detached housing versus units. And we started going down that path. You can't even put units into one lump either, because what is doing extraordinarily well and is undersupplied is the downsizer unit market for prestige, large house size apartments in lifestyle areas that might have, you know, access to the river and a view and so forth. So that is performing extraordinarily well. But as you say, the properties that were, and I want to differentiate two terms here, the properties that were built and focused towards investors, which we call investor stock, not doing so well, as opposed to investment grade,
yeah,
which is doing well. They're two different things. So where there's no scarcity, so large blocks of units, all the same, you know, two bed, two bath, single garage if you're lucky, maybe an open car space that might or may not be secured in the basement. They're what we call investor stock. They're very generic. There's low build costs and no differentiation scarcity around them whatsoever. But investment grade apartments, which are quite different, could be those three bedrooms, maybe Art Deco, aren't being reproduced, aren't going to be easily replicated. They have broad buyer appeal, so both owner-occupier and investor appeal, particularly owner-occupier appeal. They're performing quite strongly. And, you know, I'm not a researcher. I'm not a data person. I'm a behavior, property, asset person. But I'd love to see some statistics that actually looked at the difference between the performance of even those two market segments would be really interesting. But for Brisbane itself, taking away houses versus freestanding houses versus apartments, we've also got that in between a sort of marketplace, and that's really starting to take off in the townhouse segment. Townhouses are often low density. You might only have three or four on a 600 or 800 square metre block of land. They often don't have common walls. Some do have common walls. And those townhouses are almost like a middle ground between in some cities they might be called villas if they're single level. Here the townhouses generally with a living area downstairs and the bedrooms upstairs and an attached garage. And those properties are becoming more sought after. I think they're probably the story that we need to watch in 2022, because as house prices they're just outstripping first home buyer affordability, it's the townhouses that are going to be the next thing that they turn to. And we're already seeing quite a strong uplift in prices in that segment, in well-located, low-density complexes with good amenity, good layouts, surrounded by character houses, not in high-density areas, good, close to amenities, you know, ticking all the fundamental boxes, not in suburbs where there's large numbers of similar types of properties. So the scarcity factor still needs to be there. But in character areas that have lots of houses where there might be just a smattering of townhouse complexes, I think that's the thing that we need to watch this year, because they have been languishing and now that affordability factor is pushing people towards the townhouse market.
Absolutely. Very interesting. Well, we've come pretty much to the end of our time. We'll have to do a separate show on the whole rental sector because
yes, there are... Can we please? Because I've got lots to talk about.
Yeah, I've got a lot to talk about too, but that will be another hour and we probably shouldn't do it tonight. But we should do that. So we'll put something in the diary one way or the other and we'll have a particular show on the rental markets because... There are so many dynamics there. But look, brilliant insights from you tonight. If people want to find out more about you and what you do, where do they go?
The buyer's agency is propertypursuit.com.au, and the team of buyer's agents that we have there are extraordinary at their job and know the local market intimately. And I think that's something I really want to highlight too is, if you're going to talk to an expert, make sure they're a local in the area because there are a lot of broad overarching information that you can get. But if you're really focusing on an area, make sure you know that you're talking to someone who really knows what they're talking about in the area that you want to buy in or can direct you within an area. The other thing really important for first home buyers or even we've actually found a lot of our Your First Home Buyer Guide, which is the podcast that Veronica and I have, and also Your First Home Buyer Guide, which is the course for first home buyers. We've actually found a lot of people from interstate and overseas who aren't necessarily first time buyers are doing that course because they want to get to know how to buy property in the other state, in the state that they haven't purchased in previously. So homebuyeracademy.com.au is that one. Very, very well worth having a look at because we actually talk about due diligence checklists, you know, how to inspect a property, but in the right order. And I think that's a really important thing. And one thing that we found when we were researching how to present this information to people is you can find all sorts of different pieces of information around the place, but often people don't know which order to put it in. And if you put it in the wrong order, you can almost end up in this cycle of failure or end up buying something that you didn't do the things in the right step and have made a bit of a costly mistake. So buyer's agency side for Brisbane, propertypursuit.com.au and then Home Buyer Academy, which I'm pretty chuffed about. We love doing the podcast. No. Veronica, if anyone's tuned in, it's a hoot.
They're actually brilliant. And, I've had a number of people I've directed that way because what you have there is a very powerful set of tools which really help people. I want to say thank you very much for your spending some time with me tonight and with the community here. We didn't get through all the questions. We got through a good number. Thank you very much. And
great questions. Really quite insightful questions.
Good. Well, I often think that you learn more from how people frame the questions than perhaps the answers. So, it is quite interesting. And we've got a relatively great number of people on the stream who have really, really good insights as to what's going on and throw some nice curveballs, which I love. So it's part of the reason why I like the live shows. It's always a different ambience to sort of, just the sort of the standard conversations. But anyway, thank you so much. I hope that you don't get you know, too much in the way of more rain and floods up in that part of the country. And I hope that the election campaigns don't bore you too much in the next few weeks.
And I'll stick to my area of expertise.
Exactly right. And we'll catch up again soon. But I want to say thank you very much. And I really appreciate your time. And I'm going to take
you
off soon.
Thank you for having me back.
I enjoyed speaking with you. Right. See you later. Bye-bye.
See you.
There you go, folks. Great from Megan there. And just before I sign off, doggy cams, they're still asleep. They've gone round and round in circles a couple of times, but they're still sound asleep on their beds. They'll be there now for the rest of the evening and probably until tomorrow morning. They tend to come and knock on my door at about 10 to 7 to say it's time to get up. So there you go. That's the doggies. And just to say that next week, I have Tony Lecantro coming back on. Tony is going to talk about the markets, and we'll get an update from him as to how he's reading the markets. Of course, markets have fallen recently. Get an update on some of his specific stock picks, and also his view on the property market as well, particularly from a Perth perspective. So that'll be an interesting conversation. So mark your diary and join us next week. And with that, I want to say thank you very much for spending time with me tonight. Really appreciate it. And have a good evening. Have a good Easter. And we'll be back next week for another show. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. Cheerio.